Welcome to Voices.
I'm Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you're about to hear is with Mervyn Susser. Dr. Susser discovered a passion for public health during his service as a physician in a South African community clinic, during which time he forged friendships with other young intellectuals opposed to apartheid. He came to the U.S. in 1966, where he has served as the chair of the Department of Epidemiology at Columbia University and editor of the American Journal of Public Health. Dr. Susser's lifelong commitment to public health has focused primarily on reproductive, developmental, and psychiatric epidemiology, with interests also in public health history and epidemiologic methods. Dr. Susser and his wife, Zena Stain, remain devoted advocates for population health in the U.S. and South Africa. This interview was conducted by Nigel Paneth in 2002.
Greetings and welcome to Voices. Voices is a project of the journal Epidemiology, and it is a project to record interviews with leading epidemiologists in our field. We are meeting today at Columbia University Health Sciences. It's March the 20th, 2002. It's the eve of the meeting of the American Epidemiological Society here in New York. I'm Nigel Paneth. I'm professor of epidemiology at Michigan State University. And my interviewee today is Mervyn Susser, emeritus professor of epidemiology at Columbia University. And I'm going to ask a series of questions, fairly open-ended, and Mervyn will give us his views in response to them. Question number one is, right from the beginning, few people start with the intent of becoming an epidemiologist. Can you describe how your own path brought you to epidemiology?
It was very indirect. I had, before the war, World War II, I was intent on doing a degree in the humanities, thinking about literature and history. It only lasted 18 months before I was interrupted and volunteered and was out for 5 years. In that 5 years, in spite of the fact it was mostly, a lot of it was eating desert sand and abroad, I developed a fairly acute sense of, how shall I call it, social, perhaps social conscience. I mean, it was common to the times in the face of this dire threat and the awful devastation of the Hitler regime and the dictatorships. So that was one element that went into my doing what I had never intended to do at all, which was to go to medical school after my return. And there, the route to epidemiology was still very indirect. It was not a subject on the agenda of the curriculum of the time. It was, in fact, hardly a word we came across in the whole of that curriculum, although I do believe we had three or four lectures in infectious disease that were described as epidemiology. But fairly early on, as I told you, with a social orientation that I was interested in, together with Zena, who you'll be talking to, we learned of the existence of Sidney Clark, who was developing a philosophy, if you like, of social medicine, which was multidisciplinary in his view, but it certainly gave epidemiology a fairly central place in his thinking. And by the time of the second year of 6 years, when we learned this, we were able to arrange he said, we met him, and he said he'd set up a course for us.
To orient the innocent, perhaps we should mention this is all taking place in South Africa.
In South Africa, quite okay. Right. All of it. No, except the 5 years I was pretty well out of the country. And that's right. He was in Durban, 400 miles away. We managed to visit him at our Easter break. And he was very accommodating. And said he'd put on a course for us if we could bring students. So I recruited 20 students.
He would teach you
social medicine. However, it turned out that quite a good component, not by the name of epidemiology, incidentally, but the beginnings of that of an epidemiological approach were very much in what in his approach to the health of communities, you know, and which eventually that became what's now called community-oriented primary care, of which I think Alma Ata was a sort of culmination. So anyway, that made us conscious, at least, as I say, not still over discipline, but of an approach which involved systematic data collection and evaluation and examining what was on the ground where you were. Our medical curriculum was sort of orthogonal to this. It was based on American and British texts, conditions which were apparent in the white herrenfolk, you know, the segregated white half of the population, white fraction of the population. What happened in the rest of the population was foreign land. And the only way we learned about it was independently, out of hours, going to outpatients and black hospitals, Baragwanath.
Is it fair to say at that stage of your career you were undifferentiated social medicine,
yeah,
social health? Was there a time which you began to identify yourself as an epidemiologist?
Much later. That process, even though we were doing epidemiology without speaking prose without knowing it, you know, in the township of Alexandria, which we then took over, its population of 80,000, a health center there, the four of us, and we did community sample surveys and various studies, which we collected the data for. Mm-hmm. At any rate, later on we published some. And but it wasn't yet epidemiology to us. So we met epidemiology as a discipline when eventually we were, you might say, we made a polite exit, a prudent exile. Fortunately, very early on in that struggle, of the anti-apartheid struggle, and went to England in 1956, and I was then, the next year, I'm fortunate enough to get a lectureship in Manchester University in social medicine. No qualifications really that I would care to mention, except I did get membership. Not epidemiology.
Right.
But I learned then, as I started studying the academic side of social medicine in Britain, which was then the post-war discipline that encompassed the epidemiologists, is where I met epidemiology. It was one part of my spectrum, not all of it by any means. And but I knew that I had to become reasonably competent in that territory. And I suppose that's the heart of the matter. But I was not focused on epidemiology as a single discipline until I took the chair at Columbia in 1966.
So that was the official moment at which you became an epidemiologist.
Right, and I was suddenly christened an epidemiologist.
Now,
I had to make myself an epidemiologist.
The next question follows very much from your description. What's the biggest difference, as you see it, between epidemiology as it was practiced when you started your career and as it's practiced now?
Epidemiology at that point, the predominant elements of it in Britain, where I'd come from, were a concentration on chronic diseases. In the United States, that was almost not the case yet. Hmm. Still very strongly infectious disease, most of the centers, not all. And chronic disease, I believe, really only found its cachet in that next period. So it was still in the process of evolving even its basic understanding, in the, I'd say, through the late 50s and through much of the 60s, evolving its methodological skill and sophistication. Brian McMahon's book was important in that, as I think you have to treat it as a landmark book.
The 1960 first edition.
62. Before that, you had Jerry Morris's book, which was important, which also opened, threw light on where you went and how you and what you studied and how you might do it. But systematic methods were simply not there.
So now we have that systematic body of methods, you
right,
would say.
Begins. And you had had Frost and so on, of course, but formulated in a text available to all, not. So in the next 35 years, you've got, I think, in the academic world of epidemiology, an intense concentration on the development of of method and technique. It was essential and important, but it did in the academic world, I think, by the late 70s, or even, become a dominant theme. And so that the substantive focus in the academic world became, I think, less where you started from.
Do you see that as problematic?
I think it's a question, yes, I do. I think what it does, if you don't start with the problem, you start with the methods, and you've got taking a method and looking for a problem, isn't the way to go about a serious contribution to the question to what is to the fundamentals of health and the population, which is what we're about.
Who would you single out as having most strongly influenced your career?
I'll start with Koch, whom I've already mentioned.
Right.
I have to say on meeting Jerry Morris in London when we first got there, and reading his work, he opened a road to, you know, that I could see. And I was intent on an academic life. I wanted the capacity to develop my thought and apply it. And so that was a sort of beacon along the road. Later on, when I went to Manchester, mm-hmm. I did learn from the chair of my department, Fraser Brockington, who probably had no right to appoint me, you know. I mean, I was just, but they did.
We may yet interview him. He's what, 101?
He's 101.
And we may yet interview him too. I don't know.
Well, Fraser wasn't an epidemiologist. He had been a major public health officer. He ran Yorkshire County, was his territory, before he became a chair. But he was academic. Richard wrote a book about history, a short history of public health, right. History of world health, and so forth. And but what I learned from him was to see public health as a genuine discipline in itself. You know, at medical school, I think the main thing that I can remember from our public health teaching was sewage, and privies, you know, the U-shaped concrete riser, and right. A few things like that. It wasn't all like that, but I mean, there was a caricature of the limitations.
Right.
Even though there were considerable and important public health figures in the country of South Africa, I'm talking about. Still, so from him, we learned, I think I learned, to formulate public health goals for... From Brockington. To have it as a central focus of where we were going, what we were doing this epidemiology for.
Exactly.
If you were doing epidemiology. At that point, of course, I was doing other things too. I mean, I wrote with Bill Watson, the Sociology and Medicine text was my first book, our first book. No, he had another text. And so that was, because I was convinced that you, like Kark, that you know, family medicine was talked about and it was in the journals, but there was no concept of what a family was. Community medicine was talked about. There was no concept of what a community was. No systematic academic concept of what these terms embodied and how you might think about them. So that's where that book came from.
Since you mention a collaboration with a sociologist, let me turn to a somewhat less biographical type of question.
An anthropologist. Close enough.
Okay. To a more generic philosophical question, epidemiology. Collaboration is essential to successful epidemiologic studies. What have you found to be the most important ingredients of a good collaboration, and with whom have you had your best collaborations?
There's only one straightforward answer to that. I don't have to think.
Right.
It's with Zenas. And we worked together.
So you have to marry your collaborators?
I had to marry your collaborators. Well, and you have to be, we worked together as medical students. We both went to medical school at Witwatersrand University after the war. She too had been in the forces. And we knew each other as kids in Durban. The elements of that collaboration are a common goal, in the terms, I think, roughly of what I've already described, and a series and a capacity. What are the elements of it that could be more generalized, right? Is we have different, clearly all of us have different personalities, but we have different personalities that must be able to mesh, quarrel and fight, but get out of it a resolution which we both learn something from.
In fairness, marital collaboration is not your typical epidemiological collaboration.
Yeah,
can you also think of some others as well?
Oh, yes.
That might...
Well, I mean, Nigel, you'd be embarrassed, but I would include you in that. Very much. Now, we sort of started off unequal, if you like.
And we've stayed there.
No, I think that what's important is to develop a sense of intellectual equality and free exchange. Of course, Watson that's a quite a different collaboration, and it was intense and quite remarkable. It was actually Zena's fault that it happened that we suggested we should write a book she would. And I thought she was crazy at the time. He was a wild Scot, really, you know, he had a war history too. And he talked endlessly and brilliantly, you know. And he could get very paranoid. He could, about his relationships, you know, with people senior to him and so on. At the same time, and he was, on the other hand, he was a very skilled writer and full of ideas. So, to collaborate with him, which was a very successful collaboration, we stayed, you know, we survived it, stayed friends. We didn't fall out at any point. Came from quite different angles, but we had a point of intersection and a fairly common social perspective. And I think that was pretty unique. I don't know that he could have collaborated with anybody else, really. But we respected each other. He was, amongst others, he'd been a champion boxer, and he was a good hard drinker too.
did you win any arguments?
Oh yeah, I won some.
Whom would you regard as the most important epidemiologist during your lifetime, and on what basis? And of course, you have to exclude yourself.
Of course, but you have to. I'm going to redefine lifetime.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask you to say epidemiological lifetime.
Epidemiological lifetime.
Because after all, if I've started in 1921, I've got to take you back through Greenwood.
Wade Hampton Frost was still alive.
Wade Hampton Frost and all those many others.
Arthur Newsom was still alive.
Right. So there were. There's quite a galaxy there,
right,
in my lifetime, but not my epidemiological lifetime.
So your epidemiological lifetime.
It's not easy to single out. I'm quite sure that the most significant the epidemiologist hit the most bullseyes in his career is Richard Dahl.
Richard Dahl.
He was a good friend and a very good, clear mind in the very British way of reducing things to their simplest elements. Mm-hmm. With him, Orson Bradford Hill, it's hard as he was, Hill taught Dahl.
Right.
But equally important another way, mm-hmm. you know, with his absolute path-breaking book, again, we're in England, is with Jerry Morris. His uses of epidemiology, starting with an article in 1957,
right,
in the British Medical Journal. No, 55. Well, and then the book was really very influential, I think. And the next important bit of influential epidemiology, I think, was Brian McMahon. Of those who were kind of coeval with me, which is Brian McMahon and Abe Lilienfeld, mm-hmm. I don't know how I, you know, they're just different, they, and their contributions are different. But probably one's as important as the other.
That's two of the three founders of the Society for Epidemiologic Research.
Yes, yes.
Third was Milton Terrace.
Milton, right.
Could you put him up there, too?
Interesting. I think Milton's important.
Yeah.
Has been a very positive influence. But I'm not sure that his influence has been as universal in the discipline, I mean universal, as any one of those other four. Is it four I mentioned?
Well, I think if you add Abe, you've got five.
Oh, my very good friend. Well, I can't just put my friends in there.
It's interesting you've mentioned.
Oh, Abe Lilienfeld.
Yes, Abe. No, not, yes.
Abe Adelstein.
You think Abe Adelstein.
Yeah.
No, you said Abe Lilienfeld. That's four British trained and one American trained.
Yeah.
Jerry Morris, Hill and Dahl, and McMahon.
Well, and that phase of epidemiology, you know, when it was just coming out of its cocoon,
right,
of infectious disease,
right,
of a strictly infectious disease enterprise.
Right.
In that phase, it happened in Britain, essentially.
Right.
And so that's less surprising. You know, if you go to the earlier phases, you're going to have very important American epidemiologists, mm-hmm. as we've said.
Wade Hampton Frost,
and even Thomas Francis.
Thomas Francis, right.
And
as you point out, still with the infectious
Smith
disease.
Yeah.
Theobald Smith, yes. So still the infectious disease focus,
right,
in the United States as,
yeah,
pioneering epidemiology.
Right.
The chronic disease is more,
yeah,
coming out of the British.
Yes. And chronic disease was what was the centerpiece of epidemiology in my main era, anyway.
Right. And Lilienfeld carried the chronic disease.
He carried that
banner.
He carried that banner here, and
yes,
he was probably the most significant carrier,
right,
of the banner.
Right.
On the other hand, the formulator of the structure of what you did was Brian McMahon.
Excellent. Okay. Well, here's a more personal question. What do you think has been your most influential paper, and which has been your most underappreciated paper?
Yes,
if you can.
I haven't really thought about that. That's too hard. I mean, it's an, you know, I'm willing to say right now, I've probably written much too much for anybody's good.
I don't think so.
I was surprised and pleased with the very large citation and reception of the paper that I first gave in Brazil and then wrote it with Ezra called Choosing a Future, and that's quite recent.
Yes, quite recent. Published in the American Journal of Public Health.
Yeah.
In two parts, do I remember?
Two parts,
right.
Yeah. For the rest, very hard to say. As I said, I've written too much, so I don't know which, and I have to go back further, but and there are tend to be theoretical papers, I suppose, not research papers. The ones that I'm saying are most widely, was this judgment and causal inference has had quite an
American Journal of Epidemiology.
Yeah.
It also got reprinted. Also fairly recent.
It was in the 70s, okay. And it was reprinted in the early 70s, and it was reprinted in the 75th anniversary of HAE. Right. So I take it that's an impact.
Okay.
So I think that probably my sort of theoretical work has had a fuller reception than my research work. My research work is mostly, I think that may be because Zena and I, with deliberation, we choose our subjects for research with a couple of criteria. One of them was that we didn't want to go into fields that had been plowed and replowed over and over again. Second, that we wanted to do something where it would make it, where we thought it could make a difference to the ills that we were studying.
But of course, Dutch famine has hardly been ignored exactly.
No, I suppose not. Right, that has had an impact, I guess. And one of the things, but it took time. Yeah. It took time. Because I recall when teaching it here with classes like yours, right. When you were students with us, yeah. And others, we did it as some of the exercises in the 9400
well,
course.
Well, I remember.
Then we all knew that, well, this is something you'd have to follow up maybe in 20 or 30 years, and it wasn't going to be us, or you know, when our cohort grew old enough. And that's happening. That is happening.
Right. Do you think there has been an underappreciated paper, some little jewel that you thought was great and hasn't yet been captured by
the... I've got dozens.
Too many to name. All right. Well, you know, this is, again, very closely related question. Which of your contributions to the field would you like most to be remembered for?
Yeah. Well, I can't help thinking I would like the causal thinking book to be remembered. Mm-hmm. I'm pleased to see that there are still people who know the book and so on, and it's
translated into many languages.
Quite a few languages. It's 30 years old. So that's one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the famine study and the famine book is another important one for us.
Would you say the famine book was important for its results or for the way of looking at the world that it implied in terms of early origins or long-term effects, delayed effects potentially from exposures?
Yeah, I think that its long-term significance is the second, is its perspective on starting with the thesis, if you like, and looking at the ultimate outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Which we could only get to age 20,
right.
But still they're coming along now,
right.
In their 50s.
Right.
Not by us, but by our one-time colleagues and students.
Sometimes even sons.
Sometimes even sons, right. So I think, yeah.
Okay. I'm happy to say we're doing well for time, so I'm probably going to allow you to without interruption for the next few questions, I hope. Well, here's a question I'm sure you'll enjoy. What have been your major interests outside of your epidemiological activities?
Right, that's an interesting question. I could never classify myself as a man of hobbies, which I think you might get a list of from lots of people. I think that literature is an interest, and I've maintained, and history still, which were two subjects that when I first went to university, I thought one of those I'd like to pursue in academia. Well, it turns out I didn't pursue either, right? But I do still read a fair amount, not as much as, by any means, as much as I'd like to. I use my vacations especially for that. And so that's one interest. I've learned to be an improvisatory gardener and enjoyed it. And it happens that just by good fortune, as you know, we bought a derelict house. How long ago now? More than 20 years ago anyway. And 25 coming up. And it had a 2.5 acre patch, so I had to do something with it.
The first epi party I attended was in your older house, so you can use that, but the second was in your newer. So,
right,
and
okay.
I came in 76 as a student, so.
Oh, right, yes.
Just about 25 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, right. Right, so that's one that I have, that has, I mean, it isn't a central preoccupation, but it's an interest. It keeps me involved.
You haven't mentioned, perhaps because of, and it may say something about the way the question was framed, because I said outside your epidemiologic activities, and
that's
you did
right.
not mention your strong work in human rights.
Oh, yes.
And maybe you didn't exclude that from the epidemiologic compass. I'd like to think that, actually, but I don't want to add an interpretation.
Well, that's true. It has been, it was, and has been an important field of interest. And I think it flows from what I told you earlier about my war experience and one's concern. I mean, that once you got back to South Africa and had to cope with a world in which we were, you know, we had a schooling which says fundamentally we have a democratic society and we all care about the vote, and we learn British parliamentary history, and we live in a country where the people who vote and have that democracy were about 15% of the population, and the rest was others. Not in the spectrum at all. So an important impetus. Once you get faced with that paradox,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a cognitive dissonance that you can't easily, anyway, resolve if you ever think about it. And people began to think about it. But I think since then that was, having taken a posture and made a socio-political commitment, it's something that stayed with us. So that, and it almost all flowed. I mean, what perhaps our central activity, both in England and here, once you say in exile, was anti-apartheid. Was again our own regime. And then it broadened into a human rights as a something one had to pay attention to and do what one could. Yeah.
Another broad thought question. In your opinion, what has been epidemiology's most important contribution to society?
I think that's straightforward. It is the amelioration and the improvement of the health of the public. I mean, that is a fundamental contribution. For the rest, it has a scientific base. It is the, I think it introduces a serious element of rigor into all endeavors focused on the public health, if we want to put it that way. And we're not alone in making scientific contributions to public health, but epidemiology is one of the fundamentals, at any rate, of both of the endeavor of understanding what it is, what we're dealing with, what brings it about, and how what brings ill health about. What maybe brings good health about, we're not so smart at that yet. Mm-hmm. And how you might go about changing things and being sure that you've changed them for the better, which isn't always the case.
Right. Among that broad band of activities, would you choose to prioritize some more than others among the achievements of epidemiology?
I think that the without the rigor of the discipline, I think you're not going to have arrived at many of the quotes cures,
right,
or partial cures that we have known what to do. So the skepticism, the necessary skepticism of the scientific endeavor is a very important part of what is essentially an evangelical discipline amongst many of us, that is public health as a taken in the broad sense. I think epidemiology keeps your feet on the ground keeps your goals within reachable distance, or frames them so that they are within reachable distance. I don't know if that makes sense for you.
No, very much so. Well, how do you see the current state of the health of epidemiology? And what risks does epidemiology face? And on the other side, what ripe opportunities?
Well, as you know, I've been writing a fair amount over the last half dozen years, I suppose, about this. And I started with the risks. I don't know if you remember the paper on epidemiology today, A Thought-Tormented World. I never said where that subtitle came from. You know, I don't know if you know, do you?
Afraid not.
It's out of a story of James Joyce's. Uh-huh. In Dubliners, you know, that collection.
Right.
And it's this, I think it's one of the last stories. Its name escapes me for the moment now. At any rate, that's where I felt epidemiology was about a dozen years ago. Thought tormented in the sense that we were ought to cross purposes in our formulations about what it was. And at that point, and I think it's been alleviated somewhat since, we were the academic center of the field was getting diverted from the main focus of the subject onto the minutiae of methods. Mm-hmm. And I'm not to say that methods isn't central. I'm certainly don't think that, but that should be our principal activity without keeping in mind what's the object of the activity seemed to me a travesty.
And one was hearing.
Yeah, I'll name a friendly way, I think, because he was the center, he was the leader of the school of Ken Rothman's position, was that strictly the subject is it's a scientific discipline, and its objective is to do good science. At least that's how I read it. I think he's moved a bit in time since then.
In principle, not much to object to there. It's a science, it should be done well.
It is a science, but that formulation distinguished or put aside as not germane to what we were doing, the objective of the science. Mm-hmm. What is it for? It's not for anything but science.
Right.
With that perspective.
Right. I mean, discovery of the world.
The science, right. Discovering the world, advancing the way you discover the world,
right.
Especially. but not looking to discover anything specifically defined, as I define it anyway, which is that the objective is a population's health and the amelioration of it, improvement of it, advancing it.
So the risk was this disentangling epidemiology from its public health goals was a risk. But you say that was about 12 years ago, so the implication is that
it had been growing.
Things have moved in another direction since?
I think that there's been a there was always a different, a parallel stream, but I think that was becoming dominant epidemiologically, and I said as much. I also thought there was a concern that epidemiology was becoming, I don't know if you want me to elaborate on that one more, but part of it, I think there's been a counter-swing. You know, not only I, but a number of other people who have written about it, and I think it's taken hold that there is something else. Yeah, I also thought it was getting too limited, that we had an individually based epidemiology, even though we're studying populations, there were aggregates of populations and not socially constructed populations.
Is this what you mean by risk factor epidemiology or the dominance of the risk factor paradigm?
Yes, it's truly, yes. It is what I mean by it. And I'm not, it was very productive, very productive. So it's not to say it didn't have a major contribution to make. But it isn't, but you stick with that perspective and you're not in the realm of social impact and changing a population's health rather than through, you know, at several dimensions. And so I think I've always had, but I began to, with others, to what's the word proselytize for? No. Advocate.
Well, you see, use the word evangelical in another context, which I thought was pretty strong. You can use it here if you want to.
No, I don't think
not
I
Not evangelize, no.
No, I don't think I'm
advocate for.
Advocate. To advocate a multidimensional epidemiology, which takes full account of different levels of organization and different historical time.
And this is your paper with Ezra. Future for epidemiology.
That's right.
So that's is that your response to the problems posed in a thought-tormented
Precisely.
World is
yeah.
your eco-epidemiology and the returning to the level of the population
yes.
in a serious way.
He said, "What else is wrong?" And it's worrying me less now, but maybe because I'm no longer in the grant-getting business. But there was a growing tendency at that same time. Started in the 70s of epidemiology as a sort of big science. Sort of multi-centered mm-hmm. epidemiology with a central focus of analysis. Mm-hmm. And the several centers being merely data gathering.
Gotcha.
And all the many participants sort of foot soldiers, as I see it, to the diktat very often of a bureaucratic center. And I thought that was dangerous for a genuine scientific uh-huh. enterprise.
And why exactly?
Because you while it was wonderful to have the resources of government funding, public funding coming our way in some respects, it limited your freedom of action, and it wasn't always easy. It was often very difficult, let's put it that way, to promote an original idea that didn't have a foundation in a lot of other people's work already.
Mm-hmm. Stifled innovation a bit?
I think it stifled innovation.
Was an issue for you also the fact that most of those big, massive, multi-center efforts were with their acronyms were trials, not necessarily observational, the
yes.
culmination points of knowledge rather
yes,
than the
right.
initial points of knowledge.
That's so, and not, so it was not, it wasn't promoting imaginative science, let's put it that way, as I saw it. It was just what you say. And I was really, I think my best example of the period in the 80s, early 80s. He's not mine, although I was working with Zena, and you were around at the time, yeah. where she, when the HIV epidemic broke, 1982, here and in San Francisco, mm-hmm. she got excited, as she always does, about something new, unlike my phlegmatic self. and not long after a while, she was thinking, and I with her, that, well, so you have men. These are gay men. It's sexually transmitted. We didn't know it was a virus. But we do know that there are, that some gay men are bisexual. In fact, quite a substantial number probably are. Mm-hmm. So, and although it was, you know, anal penetration was the
major
format to begin with, they're going to have sex with women, for sure. And maybe also their anal intercourse isn't foreign to some people, some more than others, some groups more than others, even among bisexual, among men and women, I mean heterosexual. So it seemed sensible that one orders to Zena, and I backed her up very much, that she ought to look into the question of heterosexual transmission. Mm-hmm. So we started with Robin Flam,
right.
And she recruited Robin, our doctoral student.
Right.
And they did some very interesting observational work, you know, close-in observation,
mm-hmm.
about sex workers, with
mm-hmm.
sex workers in the
mm-hmm.
city,
mm-hmm.
and especially those involving orgies or and so forth. And having got some groundwork and some basis, wrote a proposal.
That was positing that this epidemic could spread heterosexually,
right.
based on these
quite.
Small observations.
Quite.
Very prescient at the time.
Yeah, 1983.
Right.
She then, with Robin, wrote a proposal, sent it to the study section. I was sitting in the, yes, of course, in the epi study section. I had to recuse myself. They turned it down. She revised it, sent it in again, they turned it out again. And what is it about? Well, they said it doesn't affect women. And it's a male disease.
Do you still have those pink sheets? We should signal lesson, isn't it, in scientific myopia.
Myopia. And, no, there was another reason. And she's not an infectious disease specialist.
So this was emerging from a culture of epidemiology that was really not willing to tolerate innovation, already hidebound,
so.
And so new and so hidebound already.
Right. Yeah.
How about opportunities in the future, the ripe opportunities for epidemiology now? Where do you see them?
Well, I think we cannot ignore, you know, we've been intensely focused for half a century on chronic disease.
Mm-hmm.
It gets more and more apparent. I've never wanted to exclude infectious disease, but myself. But it gets more and more apparent that both chronic diseases often have an infectious basis, unsuspected mm-hmm. for a long time. I mean, it's one of my special interests, like peptic ulcer. I knew there was something funny about it, you know, and I did actually, somebody pointed out to me, I think George Davy Smith says that in one of my papers, on cohort papers on this, I did actually allow for the possibility that there was a very specific cause of this kind. Not
maybe
exactly.
Maybe an infectious cause?
Mm.
The the cohort phenomenon that you described in peptic ulcer, I think you were the first to describe, was
yes.
really very
yes.
compatible, isn't it, with
yeah.
the
no,
infection
absolutely.
Model? The
yeah.
first example
wasn't
was
the first thing I thought of by a long way. I must tell you, not until I reviewed the subject a couple of times written a couple of papers on it subsequently. So so that's back with us as a real, a different form maybe, but there it is. It's important. And nothing brings it home more powerfully, of course, than the major health problem of the world today, which is the HIV epidemic. It says we've got to be Catholic in our perspective. What was the question I was answering?
The ripe opportunities for
epidemiology. Oh, the ripe opportunities, right. So, this is it. I mean, that the I think we have to accumulate new scientific tools and also face the new problems. They include the capacity of genomics to specify in the disease world exactly what our outcomes are and differentiate among them. But that should not divert us from the fact that for our business, at any rate, this is a specification matter. It's not the heart of what we're about.
Right.
But it's a very important one. But we have to learn to use it. And it's certainly got plenty of opportunities to bring it to bear. And I guess we're going to have to be more specialized and work in more specialized groups. We need a molecular epidemiologist to work with us in some territories at any rate, just as we want somebody very well versed in infection and so forth. So we have to be pretty wide-ranging. I think the other opportunities are to learn, to bring in methods, techniques, and people capable of developing our capacity for dealing with multiple dimensions at a methodological level. So there's a lot of room for high intellect.
Do you have any predictions about what the future will hold for epidemiology?
I think it's there to stay, for one thing. It's bound to change in its form. I think we're going to, of course, we'll specialize because the field gets more and more larger and more concentrated at the same time. We can't be omniscient, any one of us. So collaboration is a critical element of how we do the subject. And I think it doesn't get any less important, it gets more important. And more, we'll become more contributory as we learn to do it better, to take in these many dimensions better.
Again, I suppose it might fall from either of the two previous questions. What would be the single most important piece of advice you could give to a new epidemiologist starting their career? I think you met one just a week ago.
yes. Single advice. I should have thought that one out.
Well, we could start with single, but I think we will allow you to say more than one thing. Piece of advice.
My own sort of guiding lights have been two, and they're not necessarily for everybody. One is for everyone. The one for everybody, I think, is to select to t- to select a problem, a problem that seems susceptible to solution, or at least to answering, and then to find ways of getting to those answers. Don't let your armamentarium govern entirely. Right. You've got to stay, of course, somewhere within your capacities, but choose the problem.
And what
make it a problem.
What constitutes a problem?
A health problem.
Health
of
problem.
Some sort. How do we define our, say we've got these very broad social interests, how do we define ourselves from a, segregate ourselves from a sociologist in health? Our problem is a health problem.
Right.
Not a problem about how societies work or about how people interact in the private. That may have a bearing, but it's not the problem.
We were speaking earlier of a tape they did here of Jack Ellenson.
Yes.
Do you remember the story you told me once about how you and Jack divided the world into two?
yes.
Unlike Gaul, not in three, but in two parts.
Right. Well, the division was because, I mean, after all, when they recruited me, what I suppose I was known best for was the sociology and medicine text. So I wasn't going to abandon my sociological nous just because I'm an epidemiologist. You know, it's part of my armamentarium. So how do I not encroach on Jack? Specification of sociomedical sciences.
Jack was then the chair of sociomedical sciences.
Yes.
Here, when you came to be chair of EPI in 1960.
No, he wasn't. When I came, he was in a department Ray Trussell had set up called Health Administrative Health.
Oh.
And it was. At that point, it seemed to me, and this is Norway's, needn't be forever, but I think it's still germane, that I thought that you had a serious statistical element, numerical element, and you had to be able to handle that to some degree. Mm-hmm. You'll have specialists, mm-hmm. but at least you've got to understand the territory. Comprehend what it's about.
Right.
And what
reasonably
kind of
numerate.
Yeah. that you needed to have a biological substrate, mm-hmm. and that you needed a social substrate. And if you remember, we had three tracks for people who came out of any one of those disciplines, where I hoped they would cross-fertilize.
I see.
Once they went towards their graduate degree.
Should be required to get the other the other two parts if they had just one.
Right.
If they came from a social science, they'd need the biology and the mathematical and so forth.
One thing I emphasize a lot, which I know you share an interest in, but I share it with deliberation because, which is the historical evolution of whatever it is we're doing and what we're studying. Because I think that, I felt myself, let's put it this way, and I transfer that to everybody else, and I may not be necessarily right, but I think it's an important element, is if you comprehend where your disciplines come from, and where you are in the evolutionary cycle of the discipline, you know where you're going better. Mm-hmm. And you
absolutely.
So I think that's an important element too. The graduate students now find my my own PhD reading list, much too onerous, by the
way. Really?
Yes. In the historical side.
You know, I was sort of a tangent to this question, but let me, since we have a little time, I can maybe add this.
Oh, we're doing well.
We're doing all right. More than one young person has come to me and said, well, should I do medicine and do epidemiology? What is the value of a medical education in epidemiology? And I think they're not only asking it in terms of academic opportunities, which could be one way of looking at it, but also in terms of intellectual foundations. And I remember when you started the PhD in epidemiology, it was still a bit unusual to have people have their only doctoral degree be in epidemiology. They historically, like both of us, we came out of the medicine world and
absolutely.
Then specialized into epidemiology. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I've never regretted my medical education, my clinical career, what I had of it.
I mean, the suffering in anatomy was worth it.
That's true. I suppose you could put it that way. And we really did suffer in anatomy in those days, you know. I think we had some ridiculous number of hours, like 700 hours or something. But no, I think disease is the substrate that we work with all the mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. So if you're willing to go through it, I don't think you have to go through it. Mm-hmm. But I think it gives a certain, it's an enriching alluvium on which you draw on for the rest of your career. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm at sea with a lot of the modern minutiae of internal medicine, but I think I can still function as a GP in a sense. My family thinks so anyway.
They still call you, ask you for advice.
They often abandon their own GPs not because I encourage them anyway. So I think it's not to be regretted, but it's not essential, or I wouldn't have thought that you could do, at least, I could have been wrong, of course, that you could do, take this PhD straight after an undergraduate degree. And I think we have some very good people. And very capable people
successes in the epidemiologic world who have not had medical
successes.
Training, no doubt, at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pleased with. I think we've got quite a number of successful graduates. It was took a long time. It was interesting, a sort of insularity. Or at least, no, it was the impingement of the stranger. When I took over the Columbia chair, it was hard to get good students. Mm-hmm. It took quite a while before, you know, nobody knew that they might get a decent education here.
No, there was no, there still is a national issue in that there are virtually no you could say there are none, no undergraduate epidemiology majors. Therefore, unlike the fields of chemistry and physiology or biochemistry, they've seen the discipline, it's been presented in English, history.
Yeah.
As is implicit in the first question we asked you, the epidemiologists have to come from where do they come? They don't, it's not something they learn in their undergraduate curriculum. For the most part, we have an undergraduate course now at MSU, but for the most part,
very rare.
So they have to.
We really need it.
Interesting to think.
That's why I opened the PhD to, for the first time, I think, in the schools of public health, to students straight out of their first degree.
Right.
So that they didn't have to mess around another several years before they could enter public health.
Right.
You know, it was the philosophy was that you had to have field experience in public health before you could do anything in the field or be serious in the academic world. I don't think that was ever true, and it was the only way to get bright young people.
Well, we've, I think, exhausted all the specific questions. We have a little time left. We haven't completely used up our 90 minutes. So
we haven't.
Haven't quite, no.
Good Lord, there you are.
Assuming they allow us our delayed time.
Ah, yeah, I see.
We've, so let me ask you this. Given that the outside of the framework of the questions I've asked, here we are. I would like to think that these tapes will be read by, will be watched, and perhaps the summaries that may be written up will be read by young epidemiologists or people contemplating the field, or perhaps you have your own message, unprovoked by any specific questions, thoughts that you would share about the discipline or any aspect of the discipline or that might not have been covered by the questions we've posed.
I thought I'd add one thing, but it doesn't, this wouldn't bear any, isn't necessarily any stimulus to another young epidemiologist, is that I think that an interest or a concern about the intellectual formulation of what one's about in whatever field, but in certainly in epidemiology, is necessary, I think, to sustaining a lifetime in the field, sustaining a lifetime interest in the field, to see where you're going, why you're going, what is your discipline about, and what should it be about? that's been a preoccupation with many things I've done, and I think it's a sustaining preoccupation that it keeps me not content and ready to go to grass.
I think what you're saying is it's not probably for a career long view. It's not enough just to do epidemiology. You have to have some consciousness of what it is you're doing, how you're doing it, why you're doing it, some overarching and continuous sense. Maybe even questioning of it. Is that what you're saying? Wrestling with the issues and how they intersect at different times with what's going on in the health world.
And contending with what's new as it comes up, and being ready to either to learn from it, even if you fight with it.
And how does one sustain that in, let's say, among the students, the graduate students in epidemiology, or the young faculty who are struggling for grants and trying to get their papers out? Are there fora for that, or?
There are. There's a real rejuvenation in the epidemiology here at Columbia. I'm really impressed with what Ezra's managed to do in his time here. And what he's done is bring together, it's been a fortunate time in terms of funding and so on in this in this area, but he's really got a very stimulating, broad-based vision and assembly of faculty and now assembly of students. And I don't know where these students are coming from, I really don't, but he's getting, they're getting in epidemiology now very high numbers of absolutely first-rate students. I couldn't believe it. I think, given the size of the school, that they had more than 100 applicants for the doctoral programs this year, new ones, and they couldn't accept more than a fraction of them.
Wow.
And they were really first rate.
Wow.
All of them, he thinks, or at least a lot of them. So where they're coming from, I don't know, except that mostly they're women. There's a huge shift in the balance of in the sex ratio.
Though it seems to me that for as long as I've been in the discipline, more women have been in epidemiology than in many other quantitative disciplines. It seems to, is it?
Probably, but you know, when I was when I was running the department, when I was running epidemiology here, all that time, it was quite unusual that we, our balance was 50-50 all the time. It wasn't deliberate, it was just not
in students. And students.
And faculty. Yeah. Faculty.
Fran Gehring you had, and...
And Joanne Gersten, various.
Right, many, yeah.
But, so we, and that wasn't usual at that time.
Right, it was a higher fraction than in many other disciplines.
The late 70s.
But now it's even.
And it's a shift the other way altogether. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was more usual. Most schools had more men.
Right.
On the faculty and
students. Interesting.
So that's an interesting shift. We may make us, we hope it makes us more humane.
Just trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to probe. I just thought there might be some leftover corner of your mind that we haven't probed, but our time is actually up, as it turns out, so
perhaps
our timing is perfect. So
okay.
Thank you very much, Mervyn, for this wonderful discussion, conversation about epidemiology. This is Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology, interviews with leading senior epidemiologists in the world. Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Me too.
Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope that you enjoyed it. You may also be interested in a short video clip of this interview, which you can access through the journal's website. An edited version of this interview was published in the November 2003 issue of the Journal.